could just say a little about how, you know, the history of this farm, its name, how long it's been here, and how y'all got into doing what you do.
Okay. The farm is now called Hub Spooner Farms. The land was originally my husband's grandfather on his mother's side. As grandfather Stoltenberg became older, he turned over the activities to the farm to my husband's father, who is Hub Spooner. The name was later changed after grandfather Stoltenberg passed away. And now my husband farms the land for both his dad, and he also leases land that he farms himself.
So he doesn't necessarily farm this land?
Yes, we do farm this land.
Yeah, I see. Okay. About how many acres is it?
Okay, in sugarcane, in land that we own, we farm approximately 320 acres, and we lease approximately another 250 to 300 acres, which we put into fresh market vegetables each year, two crops a year, fall and spring.
What kinds of vegetables?
Mostly green beans, snap bean varieties. I'm going to have to excuse myself for a minute. I have someone here. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Okay.
So this is basically grandparental land. Do you know where the grandparents came from?
My husband's grandmother came from Wisconsin. And to be really honest, I'm not exactly sure what the roots were from my husband's grandfather. Those are the type of things I might be able to get back to you on if you feel that it's necessary.
We just really like to have that. You know?
Okay.
That's interesting because a lot of the pioneers did come from Wisconsin.
Right.
Fred Stein, family, and other things.
I would assume that grandfather Stoltenberg also came from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Huh. Now, do you grow the cane? Is that right?
No. Yes.
Who knows it for you?
We are still an independent grower for Osceola Farms, one of just a handful that they have left. We started back with them probably 25 some odd years ago when cane started becoming a main entity in this particular area. And this land at one time was used for cattle, and they had a few horses for private use.
With Osceola.
Oh, good.
Beautiful.
Okay.
That's great. So that's an interesting thing. Now, perhaps you could describe for me what I'm interested in is sort of what a day, I guess what a day in a life of farming. It's probably a week in a life would be giving you a representative idea of what goes on. But what goes into being a farmer?
Okay. My day might be a little, well, it is a lot different from my husband's in that a lot of my work stays basically inside. Although I'm an errand runner, I make decisions in the office while John's out in the field. I do ordering. I keep all of the books for both of the farms. It's real important to know what that bottom line figure is all the time so we know what we can potentially do on the farm.
Yeah.
You always have to watch. I guess what I'm trying to say is farming is usually pretty close, and we always have to have a pretty good idea of where we are at any given time. And in the area of vegetables, it's real difficult because all of the money spent usually comes out right up front, with the exception of harvesting expenses. All of your seed, fertilizer, we use, of course, only what chemicals are absolutely necessary, but there's an expense there. Of course, we have a labor expense, fuel expense, a lot of other overhead, too. Payments on tractors, insurance, a lot of the things that the government impose on us. So all of those things have to be watched. There's quarterly reports. It's quite a bit involved
yeah, so
in just the everyday bookkeeping.
Right.
agribusiness is a business now. It's not just a mom-pop operation anymore. It can't be. Everything is too technical and is getting more so every day.
About when did it start getting so technical? Can you put a date on it?
I would say probably the late 60s, early 70s, when farms started getting more mechanized and started turning over into the computer era. You know, we've moved right into it along with everybody else.
Is that so you can keep tabs on that?
Exactly. We're in the process right now of lining up and getting our own computer. Up till this point, I've done everything by hand. Mm-hmm. And it'll probably take a while to convert everything from hand over to the computer, but once I do it, it should make my job a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. At least I'll be able to go to it when John asks me anything in particular, especially at the end of the month, and I'll be able to plug in whatever I need to and have a hard copy for him to look at. Yes.
It'll be easier.
At the end of the year, it'll make things a lot easier, too. Because each month, at the end of the month, we'll have a pretty good idea of where we stand in all quadrants.
Okay, when the farming started out in the early part of the century, then, which is basically what we're talking about, how many people were involved in the farming now? And can you give a rough description of how that has grown?
The change for this area in particular?
On our farm in particular?
Well, it always has been basically just the people in the family with the exception of harvest time.
Okay.
We've been able to maintain most of the labor force through the family. Mm-hmm. Right now it's just my husband and myself, and we have one full-time employee. Mm-hmm. With the exception of harvest time. During which time we hire somebody who takes care of our labor for us.
Okay, so do you use migrant labor?
Not so much migrant labor. It's our labor is usually people that live in the community. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that pick beans are the people that did it professionally when they were younger.
Right.
And still like to come out and harvest beans.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what we'll do in a few years when we lose some of the older people that have been harvesting beans for a long time.
So the people who do your harvesting come from Bellwood?
Come from the area.
Okay.
The majority of them.
Uh-huh. And do you know of any migrant labor that comes in?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So you do have that, but it's not your majority.
It's not our majority, but yes, of course, there is migrant labor. The reason we know that for sure is the school system has a good migrant program.
Mm-hmm.
And as they move down through the state, you know, during the different picking seasons, we know about when they come in because of the change in registration at the schools. And they pretty much keep pretty good tabs on how many families are coming into the area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those people come in and work.
Right, so that the children are able to keep up with their studies as they travel throughout the states.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a pretty, very important.
It's a great program.
Now, all right, so what are you growing now? I'm trying to get
maybe a handle on
what you're
growing. Okay, right now we're getting our equipment ready,
uh-huh,
which is almost in the finishing stages now, and we're getting the land black, which means we're getting it ready to plant seed.
Okay.
And we'll probably start seed planting about the 15th of September.
Mm-hmm. And what will you be planting?
Mostly green beans. We'll have a few other peas and beans,
mm-hmm,
and in our late fall planting, we'll plant some English sweet peas and some pea pods and that sort of thing. We're trying to branch out a little bit, because variety seems to be the name of the game. You never know when it comes harvest time if you're going to have a market for your product.
Really?
It fluctuates daily, and sometimes more than one time during the day. They have these Florida Vegetable Record. It's a marketing sheet that comes out every day, and I'm able to keep up with throughout the state, Florida, and other states what the market price is for that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it fluctuates a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
About how much?
Well, that's really a difficult question because it can be, for green beans, say, the market could be anywhere from as low as $3 to up to as much as $20, which is kind of unseen or unheard of, mm-hmm. but it does happen from time to time, and that happens when beans are scarce. So if anybody should have beans at that time, that's a little bit of a bonanza for them. But at the same time, if they have beans, somebody else probably has been wiped out. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where unless your neighbor's hurt, you're probably not going to make any money. That's kind of unfortunate. And we're dealing every day with elements that we can't control. You know, a lot of people forget about that. We have a note due at the bank, the same as everybody else does, but we can't control a lot of the elements that go into making that payment, mm-hmm. one of them being the weather.
Mm-hmm. Right, weather, yeah. Over the years, well, do you know how the family dealt with the 1928 hurricane, the 1926 storms?
The homestead was built just after that, but I believe that they had some of the land, and if I'm not mistaken from the stories that have been, you know, passed on to me, that livestock was wiped out during, you know, during those storms. And there were an awful lot of people killed out in this area.
Oh, yeah. Were any of this family?
Right here. No. No. Thank God.
Yeah.
A lot of family members in this community, though, a lot of grandparents that were killed in that storm. The Steins and Schlechters, quite a few of those families can all relate to those storms. Oh, thank God for the dike. Although that's not one of the things that I feel safest about either. I'm sure the Corps of Engineers wouldn't like to hear me saying that. But Mother Nature does funny things.
Have there been any other kinds of things like that that have happened?
We've had tornadoes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. We had a tornado that came through on New Year's Eve this past year. It went through the campground, which is just to the west of us here, and turned over 20-some-odd trailers and went through the golf course and took out some of the really old trees. And I don't know how we got this lucky, but it bounced up just enough that all it did is it went through our cane and flattened it, jumped up, hit the antenna on the top of the house, took it down, and skipped on across to the other side of the cane field. I was in the shower at the time. It sounded like a freight train in there with me. It was incredible.
Oh, were you taking a shower?
Yes.
Oh, no. No, you're not supposed to do that when you throw it in your house.
Well, how do you know? You know,
it was real quiet before it hit.
Well, it was just raining.
Oh.
And,
you know,
just getting ready to try and enjoy ourselves. It had been a pretty bad month, and we were kind of looking forward to seeing 86 leave. It went out in grand style.
Had it been a bad year in terms of your market?
It had been a bad year and a half.
Really?
Yes.
How come?
Mostly weather. Mm-hmm. One of our crops was washed out by water. And then this spring, we thought that it was going to be another loser for us. We had a late freeze. It was April the 3rd or April the 4th on a Saturday night. Went down to 18 degrees in some of the fields, which is a hard frost. We registered 18 on one farm, and we have a cousin who registered the same or lower on one of his farms. And lost most of the crop, but somehow, I guess God was looking out for us. We had a little bit that survived. And because everybody in the area was wiped out, the market was good, and we made enough to recoup our expenses. So, you never know.
You never know.
No.
So, the sugar cane harvest take place at the same time as the bean harvest, or does it staggered?
It staggers. Now for us, we have what they call a late cut, and we don't cut anything until after February. So we take a gamble that we won't be froze out, which has and can happen. But we also, by taking that extra gamble, if it works out in our favor, we have a longer good weather growing time than some of the other farmers do. So it's 50 one or 50 or the other. It's just a chance. So far the cane looks like it's doing pretty well. We've just had a service come out and look at the cane. They specialize in testing and looking at cane, and they've told us that we have a couple of problems which we'll be taking care of in the next few days. But you don't want to do anything too fast. You don't want to jump the gun, because you don't want to put anything on any chemical on any crop unless you absolutely have to. Because there's a lot of times if you hurt one type of insect, you hurt the insects that are good for you too. So you don't ever want to disturb that balance whenever you don't have to. There's, you know, we have a lot of editorializing about what we spray on our plants and so on and so forth, but I can guarantee you there's not a farmer that I know of, and probably not too many across the United States, that don't use what is absolutely necessary and never more than they ever have to. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess a lot of people forget we eat the food too.
Yeah.
You know.
What do you think the stereotype of the farmer's been? That's an interesting point.
Has been.
And what do you think it is now? Can you talk about how long have you been in the family?
I still think a lot of people think that the farmer, quote unquote, is the elderly lady with the cotton gingham dress on.
Okay.
And maybe not a lot of intelligence. I have a phone call. Before you turn, oh, okay,
yeah.
Stereotypes.
The old lady in the gingham dress and that being the corresponding.
Yeah, and they think of all of the farmers being in overhauls and boots, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we were that type of people, we would not be farming, because those type of people aren't farming anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep up with everything that's going on. You can see right there, that's the periodicals that came in yesterday. And I usually reserve Saturday mornings for reading just all of the material that came in during the week that I didn't have a chance to read. And you have to keep up with it. If you don't, I guess it's like being a doctor. You just start falling behind. And when we go up to Washington, and I don't really lobby, more what we're doing is a educational process for our legislators so that they have a better idea of our needs. And we do tours too, so that they can come down and actually get on the farm, get off of the concrete from DC and see what we're doing and why we need their help, etc., etc. They have that idea too, that we're all backwards type people. I don't know where they think all of this food comes from.
What is their reaction when they find that it's not
food? I think at first there might be mild shock. And then after that, I think they're pleased. And then after that, I think they get excited about learning what we have to tell them,
really?
You know, and show them. There's a lot of interest then in agriculture, how we grow things, obviously not why we grow them, because we all like to eat three meals a day, but the why-fors of farming, you know, what goes into creating and making and harvesting a crop.
What goes into creating and making?
It's pretty exciting. Right now, a lot of the fields are overgrown. So you try not to till them any more than you absolutely have to, till or disc them. The more that you do, you lose soil into the air when you do that. So we let them cover with weeds, and now we're cutting them all down, and that'll be disced under, it'll decay and die. the land will, they'll finish land preparation and then they'll start planting seed.
And the seed dropped in?
The seed's dropped in. Mm-hmm. The planter actually takes and makes a little furrow. The seed's dropped in, and then there's a little wheel that goes over the top of it and covers it back up. And then there's a person, sometimes myself, that stands on the back, and if for some reason it doesn't get covered up or the seed doesn't go in properly or the hoppers aren't filled properly or whatever, that person gets to hop up and down off the tractor and do it with their feet or their hand, depending on what part of the process has been messed up. So you don't want your rows skippy. You know, obviously, if you've got a skippy row, you're not going to have an even crop. So that's the beginning of it. And it's just exciting to watch the seed pop through the ground and watch the process all the way through.
Now, if you're planting about September 15th, about when will that seed start to pop?
Depending, again, on the weather. It's hot right now. And we need more moisture in the soil, so lack of moisture will sometimes make the seed take longer. Too much moisture will make the seed rot. So just weather has an awful lot to do with it. Heat will make it pop out faster. When we have cold nights, it slows the crop down. Hot days and night, the crop jumps. So we'll probably see our first seeds in 3 to 4 days come out. And we'll start harvesting just a little bit before Thanksgiving. So it's probably about 45 days.
It's a very quick.
Quick.
It can be just as quickly destroyed.
Yes. It can take 30 minutes to an hour to destroy an entire crop if we have too much rain, too hard, too heavy, with a lot of wind. It blows the plants over, and they don't like wet feet at all. They like moisture in the soil, but they don't like it wet. So we've picked a crop that's not the easiest to grow.
Beans.
Yeah. But it's, I guess you would say, it's kind of one of John's loves. It's just one of the things that he always thought he'd like to grow, and he's good at it. When we have the right conditions, we've got beautiful plants with an abundant amount of beans on them.
Yeah, there's something to do with gambling with that, you think?
John's a gambler.
Okay. You think all farming's a gambling?
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Sure, we could have lightning strike that field this afternoon and it'd burn it all down. People don't think about those things. The dike could break and everything would be flooded out. Now, there are insurances, but you can only afford just so much insurance, too. You can eat whatever profit you do have up with different types of insurance. They're there, but they're extremely expensive.
And what about the cane? Do you see the cane as a kind of a stabilizing?
The cane would probably be more stable than vegetables to a certain degree. And even with a price support system, you still have to be a good farmer to make a profit on the crop itself. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with cane, too. A lot of diseases that you can't pull them out of. You know, and anything that you do to a crop, especially cane, to try and counteract a problem that's begun in it, slows the crop down. So you lower your tonnage, and you will probably be lowering your sucrose levels, too. And that's what you're paid on, is tonnage and sucrose levels. Because you've probably found a lot of that out from working with Osceola.
Yeah. So now Osceola's harvesters come in and...
They come in and they harvest the cane, harvest and mill the cane for us.
Kind of interesting to have the cane cutters right in your front yard.
Yeah. They show up about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And they make a lot of noise. The first time I ever heard it, it scared me to death.
What did it sound like? Tell me about it.
They chant.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And they sing a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they start sharpening the machetes. And the cane has already been burned, so we don't have there's a higher level of noise than there is when the cane has leaves on it, because it's like a buffer.
Yeah.
And
can you tell me some of the things you've heard come out of the cane field? No, seriously.
You mean animals or?
No, the sound, the chants.
Oh, the chants. I don't understand any of them.
Mm-hmm.
The people are real curious. They're real curious about Americans. We have mostly offshore workers that cut the cane. You cannot get domestic Americans to cut cane. The work is so extremely hard. I've tried it. It's tough.
Yeah.
You know, I got down about 5 feet and was about exhausted. I mean, down a 5-foot row and couldn't hardly move anymore. And they do hundreds of feet in a day.
Yeah.
It's really incredible the strength that some of those people have. Have you ever talked to them about their diet, what they do for lunchtime and so on? Their lunches usually consist of things like beans and rice, things that are real high in protein. And they do weigh a ton, but by the time, you know, between breakfast and lunch, these people are hungry. And they, each one of them has a water container that they carry with them, and they drink all during the day. I understand some of them sweeten it with sugar, you know, just to keep their energy levels up. But I would really like to be able to talk with some of those people, but, you know, we have a language barrier to a certain extent. And
actually, it's not the language, because Jamaicans speak English.
I can't understand them. You know,
it's a very fast and shortened English.
It's clipped.
Oh, yes, very.
Yeah, and I don't understand them. And of course, dealing with Osceola, we're dealing a good part of the time with Spanish-speaking people, and so I have a little bit of a difficulty there too.
Yeah. But also, there's the issue of the age too.
Yes.
That's where I am immediately prohibited.
Right. Well, we would not be able to harvest our crop without those people coming in and helping us, working. And I know that every season it seems like there's always a labor dispute. But I've gone to Osceola and asked to see what the cutters make, you know, that type of a thing, to see, you know, whether they are being paid what we're told they're being paid. And from what I can tell, they are. And the good cutters are making very good money, extremely good money.
Yeah, I like the 60-40 rule. That's a nice
one. Yep, they get good benefits. If they're a good worker, they are allowed to come back the following year, providing, you know, that they haven't committed any type of crime or have any type of communicable disease. I'm sure they're watching all of that a lot more carefully these days, too, which is only not only for their own benefit, but for all the people that they work with and ours, too.
Yeah.
So.
It's interesting because it sounds like you just got a lot of different kinds of people working with you.
With us.
Get the offshore labor, which is primarily Jamaican, and then your community labor for harvesting the beans. Is it black, white?
Basically black.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as you know, Belgrade has a large Haitian community now,
right.
Too. And the Haitians do a lot of the agricultural work also. They're learning, you know, new skills, and they're working on the farms now also. There we have another communication problem.
Yeah, how's your Creole?
Not too sporty. I know very few words. I can barely get by. But they are real good about doing what you do. Now, you can show them what to do. And, you know, by doing it, you eliminate a language barrier. You know, come on, follow me, you know, do what I do. And that helps a little bit. Of course, you usually try to find somebody who's bilingual.
Yeah.
to work with you so that they can communicate what you can't communicate with your hands.
Do you work with the Haitian Counseling Center?
We have, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that during the season, the employment service works with them too. They try to get names of people that are bilingual so that they, you know, have those names available for the farmers so that they can hire them on their farms to help out.
So basically, okay, so you have all the different kinds of people, and then you have Hispanic too. And basically what you're working on is what the farming sounds like in some ways. It's preparation.
And now we're in a maintenance stage. And then you have a stage where you land prep or get everything prepared for the crop. Mm-hmm. You don't plant it all at one time. You skip plant. Now, we plant usually every other day. Because if you planted it all at one time, you'd have to harvest it all at one time.
Yeah. I wonder how many of us think about that. Planting.
So as we go along, not only are we planting, but we're going back and we're doing the maintenance work that's necessary on the plants that are already coming up and growing.
So how do you schedule that? So you're planting and one day maintaining the next?
A lot of it is by sight. John knows what he needs to do by walking the fields. Mm-hmm. And we usually walk, as the crop gets a little bit older, we usually walk the field together. And I'm getting a little more experienced at picking out things that are right and things that are wrong with the crop too. And I'm a little bit better at seeing overall coloring, because color has a lot to do with, you know, how healthy the plant is too. And my perception for that is just a little bit better than John's. And so I can help him out in that way too. So it's interesting, and that's a time too that's a little bit of time for just he and I. Even though we're working, you know, we get a little bit of time together too, and can have a little bit of private time to discuss some of the things that I haven't had time to talk with him about that have happened in the office, or things that I think that we need to do, and vice versa, things that he's done that he's forgot to tell me.
Right. Now who does, with the vegetables, who does your packing and getting
them out? We do our own grading and packing. So that's another aspect. Not only, you know, you're harvesting on the same day that you harvest, you're grading the crop and packing it and getting it into cold storage. Mm-hmm. You try to do it just as quickly as possible. So during the years, you know, we've worked out a pretty good program, but you always have hitches. You know, you have a motor that blows, or a fan belt, or, you know, fan blade that blows off, or just, there's just thousands of things that can happen. Mm-hmm. That just puts a cog in the whole system and it all stops.
give me an example.
Well, say we were grading beans and the motor went on the grading belt. All of the grading stops until you can replace the motor. And that usually means finding an electrician that's open, and most of our grading is done at night, so we usually have to find somebody at home. And in an agricultural community, they understand the importance of getting back into the, you know, getting back on the grading belt or getting back in the field or whatever as soon as possible. Because every time you stop, it's costing money. Mm-hmm. You know, as you have people standing there that are being paid by the hour, and they're just waiting for something to do. So, and you have tires blow on your trucks, bringing the beans from the field to the grading belt. Just all kinds of things.
Where's your packing?
It's here in Belglade.
It's here in Belglade. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not our packing house. We lease space from a packing house. And that particular packing house also takes care of selling and shipping our beans. So after we're packed out, we're basically, as far as our labor, we're finished. But then we're turning it over to somebody else's hands and pay them for a service that they do for us. And it's not until after the distributor is paid that we are paid for our crop. So that's usually 30 to 90 days after the fact. So that's another reason why that bottom figure is so important, because you've got to be able to stretch for a long period of time.
Can you think about traditional practices, I guess, that are still involved in farming now? You said one, eyes, just walking the fields.
Mm-hmm.
What other ones can you think of? Non-mechanized practices.
Well, most of the discussion around the breakfast and dinner table is all farm-related, too.
Really?
It's very, very difficult to get away from the farm. You know, you just have, while you're working, you just have to be there just about 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Holidays don't count, Sundays don't count. And it's a lot more difficult than a lot of people probably think about. It's not a job where I go to work at 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 5 o'clock I punch a card and I leave, and I don't have to think about it until the next day. It's something that you live with around the clock. But I don't want to give it up either. It's something that it's exciting to a certain extent, sometimes very tiring. Never very boring, though, because there's always something happening, something going on. The growing is exciting. Harvesting is exciting, especially if you have a market where you think you'll be able to come out ahead. Making ends meet is always nice. And with all of the hard work that you put into it, you hope, you know, that you get something more than satisfaction out of harvesting a crop. Mm-hmm. You know, prosperity needs to come in there somewhere, too. There's reasons why we're working so hard. Our idea is to get ahead, too. And eventually, we hope to accumulate more land. Although that's getting more and more difficult to do all the time. If you don't have family-owned land, it's very difficult to obtain anymore.
When you don't have family-owned
land? Mm-hmm. It's just so expensive.
But basically all the land
prohibitive.
You have is family-owned and there's no more.
Well, the 200-plus acres,
yeah.
And then we lease the rest.
Oh, okay. You lease the
rest. Right.
Lease the rest.
Right. So that's another expense, too, that sometimes I even forget to think about, you know, whatever contract we've made with the owner of the land, that has to come out from somewhere, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Whether you make money off of the crop or not, the land rent still has to be paid. So. I hate worrying about the finances, but that's just a big part of anything that anybody does today.
Yeah.
Part of life.
So you've got, in terms of traditional things, the breakfast and dinner discussions.
Mm-hmm.
That means you got off from breakfast all day to worry about anything and be able to bring it up.
At the dinner table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And my father-in-law, we eat as a family. Even though John and I live in the little apartment that's attached to his house, I generally do the cooking for the whole family, and we share meals together.
So you talk about a number of things over. So you talk about a number of things. Do you talk about just the farm stuff?
No, just things that have happened in the community. This is a real close-knit community.
Is it?
Mm-hmm, extremely. Politics.
You get some elections coming up,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Local elections, and everybody's already starting to think about national politics, too. You know, doesn't happen until next year, but now is when a lot of the decision-making goes on. And I guess probably because of some of my activities were a little bit more involved in politics than we were several years ago. A lot of that being that I deal directly with some of our elected people.
Okay.
It is. I don't want. There we go. Wrong way. Just like that. I want to be able to see you.
Yeah.
Great.
There you are.
You know, and just family-related things, too. John has a brother who lives and works in West Palm and basically has nothing to do with the farm on a, you know, a day-to-day basis. He has really no desire to.
You wouldn't
have a chance for me to be with Buzz? No, Buzz is the principal in Wellington. We haven't really ever had a chance to sit down and see whether somewhere along the line we are or not, but not immediately. I did a speech for one of the groups that he's president of over there, Rotary, and we had a little bit of an opportunity to talk about it, but there's a lot of spooners out in the Glades, and most of us are all farmers. Mm-hmm. John has a cousin and an uncle that both have farms, and then he has another uncle who sells tractors, and all of it's agriculturally related. And let's see, immediate family, those are the farmers in this particular area. Well, now, the Spooner side of the family really didn't come from the Midwest. They came from the Georgia area, Georgia, Alabama, up around that area. Trying to think of the name of the little town, Colquitt, Georgia. Colquitt. Let's see, I used to know how to spell it. They make a jelly that they're famous for. Colquitt. No, Colquitt. Mayhall. Mayhall jelly. Colquitt and Mayhall are close to each other. And Mayhall is actually, I think, closer to where John's father was born. And a lot of the Spooners came from there. They were a lot of the original settlers in the Pahokee-Belglade area. In fact, the first doctor in Pahokee, his name was Spooner. Mm-hmm.
Now, how many of the old farming families are left in this area?
Not that many. We have an annual celebration called the Black Gold Jubilee in our area. I don't know if you know anything about it or not. Remind me, and I'll give you a booklet from last year's Jubilee. They had the community saluted some of the farm families from the area. And I think there were somewhere between 12 and 15 families. I work with the Black Gold Jubilee Committee also.
When does
that falls in April, generally in April. And I would say if you go through the book, because each one of them were saluted, there's a little bit about the family and a picture. And most of those families are the families that are still farming second, third, and fourth generations in this area. And John and I were part of that group.
So what are you, third?
Third generation. Mm-hmm.
So there's 12, 15 families, much more than that at one time.
Oh, many
why,
more.
Why the reduction?
I think some of the families branched out in other things. Not all of the farm families made it. Some of them weren't able to tolerate the hardships of the land and the area. There's a lot of people that, the young people, don't want to have anything to do with agriculture. You know, they've looked at their parents and some of their forefathers before them and saw that there wasn't a lot of money to be made in it. And they've decided to go elsewhere. And they just, I don't think that the love of the land is just inbred in everybody. You know, John and his brother are prime examples. John's brother basically doesn't want anything to do with the land. John can't stay away from it. And John is a real estate broker, too. He has another trade other than farming. And he hasn't pursued it a great deal in the past few years because farming does take up so much of his time, of our time. We were just discussing the other day, if we don't see a movie in the next couple of weekends before we get cranked up, we won't have seen one all year. Just, you know, just a matter of time. There's just not time for everything. So we have a few interests that we do pursue when we have time off. And we both like to scuba dive and we like to fish. And, you know, ocean fishing. For the big stuff. No, not the specks and bass. As a matter of fact, as long as I've known John, we've never fished in the lake, and it's only a stone's throw from here. But basically, again, that goes back to time. You know, generally when John comes in from the field and gets cleaned up, he's too tired, and it's dark. You know, and he's up at the crack of dawn, so that doesn't leave much time. I've been a part of the farming operation now for about the last 8 years. John and I have only been married 2, but I came out here, well, quite a few years before we were married and worked with him, really learning, you know, because I knew basically nothing about agriculture. I read all of his periodicals, you know, I read everything I could put my hands on. And then realized that farming was in a lot of trouble, too. Mm-hmm. You know, agriculture in general.
What were some of the first things that you taught?
I'm laughing because I made so many mistakes. And there's a couple of jokes because of that. You know, we would ride around and he would introduce me to pieces of equipment and tell me what different weeds were and what was good and what was bad and all that sort of thing. And one day we were riding along and there were some weeds in his crop, and I asked him if he was going to titillate the beans. And he laughed and almost got hysterical, and I still didn't quite know what my mistake was. No, he said he was going to titillate them. He didn't think that they would like being titillated. Yeah. He was, though, from my comment. So, anyway, I've made my share of humorous mistakes along the way. And you make mistakes. I've learned from my mistakes, too. You know, sometimes I've made the wrong decisions here in the office, too. Thank God none of them have been irreversible or something that we weren't able to deal with. But you sometimes have a communication problem because I like to stay up at night to do my book work when the phone's not ringing off the hook. John goes to bed because he gets up at the crack of dawn. He usually lets me sleep in till about 7 or so. And so a lot of times in the morning we miss each other. So if there's something that I'm supposed to do, he'll leave me a note. And sometimes he's made arrangements for things that I don't know about. So I'll just have to, when the phone rings, make a decision one way or the other if he's not available. You know, as we have leased land as far as 20 miles away from here. And a lot of that being over a Shell Rock Road, so we're talking an hour round trip to get to the farm and back. So anytime anything happens, I can't just run to the farm, you know, because I'm needed in the office. and well, we haven't gone to that expense yet because we don't feel like they're perfected enough yet. One of the problems being that we can't reach out far enough with a mobile phone for me to be able to talk to him when he's on some of the farms without going through a couple other mobile phones also to get to him. And people don't mind doing that, but I'd say probably within the next year we'll probably have a mobile phone. It'll make things a lot easier. So, another expense.
It's all in the name of keeping
the top. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. We did the same thing with computers. We kept looking at them, and I took took some classes out at the junior college and got ready. You know, now we've just basically been looking, finding one that has the programs that we need most, because all of the computers don't have everything you need.
What do you find you would need the most?
Well, not only do we need the bookkeeping, which is real important, there's programs now, too, that basically give you profit and loss depending on different factors that you can punch into it. You know, so we might be able to make some decisions based on a scientific, well, based on science and what other people have experienced, you know, programs that have been worked on for quite a few years and a lot of input put in from not just one farmer like ourselves, but quite a few. And that might lead us to a better decision than we've maybe made in the past. You just never know. So we're looking at some of those type programs, too. And they'll be more developed as we go along, too. So we needed to look at a unit that would adapt to other things later on, too. So we needed to find one where if a program was on IBM and we wanted to put it on the Apple or whatever, you know, that we would be able to convert it from one to the other.
You always
adapt, and you're never caught up. There's never enough hours in the day, and I'm a worrier. You know, I feel like I have to have everything done at night before I can go to bed, and that's real bad for the type of job that we've got. It's
plus acres, can't
harvest at all. No. I'm trying to change my ways a little bit too. So, you know, that's another aspect that I guess I'm having to look at. I've gotten better over the years. Weather used to just blow my mind. And I still get upset, don't get me wrong, because when you see your crop being washed away, it's not easy to deal with, but you just have to work at being optimistic.
Yeah, do you find yourself having any superstitions?
No, not really. Mm-mm. Nothing has ever really seemed to follow a pattern, you know, as far as bad weather. I was beginning last year to think that we were jinxed in some way. You know, everything we did, they were the right decisions at the time, but another element would come along and, you know, knock them out. So, and you know, it just seemed like the harder we worked, the behinder we were getting, and the further in the hole we were getting. And it's distressing, emotionally, physically, mentally, always. You know, we weren't sleeping well. It's hard on a relationship, too, when things are really going backwards. But we were just lucky enough, I guess, by the grace of God, too. Was looking out for us. We were able to pull ourselves back up by the bootstraps and we're planning again in 2 weeks. So you wanted to know a little bit about
Ag
in the classroom too.